Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
March 5th, 2017, episode number 105, All Natural. Greetings one and all, and thanks for stopping by. My name is Kevin England, and I'm happy to have you listening in. If you listened to our last podcast, then you know that this will be another episode that differs from our normal cadence of things. Typically, we do a local hive report, a segment or two, and run through roundtable topics, but today I'm going to feature two segments, one on my thoughts of where I'm going in 2017, since I haven't talked about that yet, and another on the ways of biodynamic beekeeping. This is the episode I recorded a week or so back, but because of personal plans, didn't get to release it. So keep in mind that the local hive report's a week old, but things are still status quo, as reported. I'm recording this intro after the release of episode 104, and wanted to throw in a quick recollection of an important part that I left out from the Samuel Ramsey talk on varroa feeding on fat bodies. If you didn't listen to that episode, go back and listen to it. It was really, really a good recap from Philly and amazing speakers all the way around. I would normally not make an exception for a detail, but duh. It was probably one of the top three things he disclosed and I left it out, so I feel an obligation to call it out and make things that are wrong with the world right again. It had to do with the insight that the varroa mite is feeding on the fat body layer of the bee just underneath the shell, and that their mouth parts were not long enough to get to the hemolymph in most cases. The important part is, while the mite is getting something to eat, is there something in particular they are looking for nutritionally? The thing that I left out is that the mites are after the vitellogenin, and nutritionally they are harvesting the remains of the organ tissue left over from when the bee developed. Recall, if you listened to the segment, that the bee, as it went through its metamorphosis, stored its early organ tissue from the larva stage into the fat body tissue, and part of what they're seeing in the mite excrement was output of eating organ tissue. I mentioned this in the segment, but never put the exclamation point on it. There's one other thing going on there, too, and it has to do with the vitellogenin. I also mentioned in the segment that vitellogenin is an egg yolk precursor. In the study, Sam and team were able to get the mites to lay an egg, something not done before in the lab setting. It appears that the varroa mite are feeding on the bee fat body and specifically exploiting the vitellogenin for egg development, something they don't have much ability to or at all to do on their own. Yeah. Those were kind of some important things to leave out. I listened back to the episode over this weekend and realized that I built in the insights to lead to those conclusions, but in my haste to be summary, left those important parts off. So, sorry about that. My understanding and takeaway from the talk was that without vitellogenin and the tissues that are in the fat body, the mite will not be all that it can be. Recall that it did not survive when starved and only lasted a day or two on hemolymph. Without fat bodies and the substrates that make it up, it will not have the nutrition it requires, and it will not have the egg precursors to lay eggs, and that could equate to no baby varroa or eggs that would be malformed. If somehow these new understandings can be exploited in a way, then you might have the Achilles heel to the varroa mite. This to me now becomes the second discovery that is sitting and waiting for someone to do something with. The other was the Peter Thiel discovery about small hive beetles in the "This is really cool" segment from episode 37. I wonder what became of that. I was listening to the second episode of the Beehive Jive, where they were talking about Varroa. Nope, sorry. They were talking about hive beetles sliming hives. By the way, if you haven't listened to that podcast, both the episodes that they put out so far are just really well done. Enjoyed listening to them. I think it's the beehivejive.com. You could check that out. So, you know, these two things are sitting there, and it takes a lot of money and whatever to make a commercial product and get to it. But I would love to see somebody exploit the science that and the learnings here and figure out something to combat both small hive beetles and Varroa mite. Now I feel a little better having righted that wrong. I was really frustrated with myself driving down the road, listening to that and realizing my faux pas and yelling at myself internally. I was thinking about that whole episode in itself, and you know, there was a lot of risk in putting that episode out because I'm recounting what people say, hearing it for the first time, trying to remember what I thought, inflecting my own thoughts on what I thought it meant, and in some cases, going by memory, which is always a concern. And if all of the researchers and presenters that day went back and listened to what I said, would I have gotten it 100% right? Would they have taken issue with some of my reflections or inflections? Don't know the answer to that. And my hope is that down the road, I'll be able to bring them in and let them say what they're going to say. And you'll hear it directly from them. So I always give a little caveat word of warning to everyone who listens. I'm doing my best, not always perfect, have to wonder where I've made my mistakes, but ignorance is bliss. I put these things out, and I could be stating some things wrong. It gives a little more impetus on, it would be great if you went and saw them yourself, but if you don't, I'm hoping you can trust, and I will say that in the case of Megan and Sam's talk, I recorded them for my personal use so that I could listen back to them. And I drove for a couple days listening to Megan's talk over and over again just to make sure that I got the essence of what she was looking for and pulled out some of the key points, because there are just certain ways she said something that were really important in conveying the message. And I thought it was outstanding the way she presented it, and I wanted to try and emphasize the way that she laid the story arc out, as I had said in the episode. I think in the last episode I had mentioned that it was November, December, or whatever, but from my understanding it was an October issue. I repeat again that I generally don't subscribe to American Bee Journal or Bee Culture because I don't want to skew my reporting by people getting a sense that I'm stealing what people are saying in those magazines, so I don't read them. Occasionally somebody gives me one. Bob Kloss gave me one that he obtained recently, an extra, and has something on Seeley and Darwinism and other things. I haven't read it yet, but I intend to go back and take a look at that one. I am curious what gets said in there. I did read the editorial in there about Varroa mites and Randy Oliver's response. I thought that was an interesting exchange. So I do find a huge amount of value in reading those magazines. But again, as somebody trying to be non-biased and... Anyway, it is what it is. I'm glad that things are right. And let's go ahead and get started. The local hive report for this episode is a mixed bag. I did get to check in on my hives a few times since the last episode, and like many, I've heard that a lot of hives were lost this winter. So for me, that means all 8 nukes in my 8-frame hive have perished, but the 4 hives at the farm and my 3-deep Langstroth hive sitting in the yard is doing okay. And they look reasonable to the point where I think they're now past the hump and will survive. I'm starting to see the crocus up. I'm starting to see the snowdrops up. And as soon as the bees make it to that point, they almost never perish after that fact here in New Jersey. So we've had some unseasonably warm weather here in New Jersey over the past week or so, and many beekeepers that I know of took the opportunity to take inventory of their hive losses. And we had a beekeeping meeting this past Friday, and from what I heard, other beekeepers have a mixed bag too. Some had some heavy losses. Some had two hives and both made it through. The overall accounting from beekeepers I spoke to seemed to indicate that quite a few hives did not survive this year. Coming back to my nuke situation, I did some inspections and, well, it seems to be a cascade of things that caused the problems. Let me start with the single nukes that I had in the middle of the condo. Three of them were from Northwest, on loan to me to see if I can overwinter them. And the one was made from a late swarm that I got from someone, and I propped it up with resources. I employed a strategy where I thought these were the weakest hives, so I'll put them in the middle and they'll benefit the most from the heat. And my lesson learned was that was not a good idea. I don't think that these bees had enough total warmth in conjunction to make it through winter. And one of the things you could think about the way I had it was I had a bottom board, a single nuke, a screen bottom board, and a single nuke, and I allowed the heat from the bottom one to pass through. There was no roof on the bottom hive. And then I put a feeder and so on. So it was one contiguous hive separated by a screen bottom board. And the gap that it made from the bottom board was plugged, so nothing could get in, and no heat would escape except for out of the top vent hole. And these two hives, one over one, were set next to each other in the middle of the stack. And I think they were the first four to go in succession. I don't believe they made it to December. Now, the difficulty is, in the new condo, even though they were wrapped in insulation and didn't make it, they were in the middle, and the hive to the far left, it suffered a fate where it was out there by itself with nobody to help heat through the walls. That hive, I love that hive. I coddled that hive all the way through with hopes of overwintering it. And I have to tell you what I found just makes no sense to me. At first I would think that that hive died from being too cold or something. But the fact of the matter is, I have no clue. Here's what I found. Nothing. Hive was empty. Empty. I mean empty. And when you open the hive and you look, the bottom box, it's a five-frame nuke with a five-frame nuke sitting over it. It had a feeder on the top with insulation, and above the insulation was food. In case it got warm, they wanted something to eat. And then it was wrapped in inch and three-quarter styrofoam. This hive was flying sometime in December timeframe, because when I went out on Christmas Day and took FLIR images, I could see heat coming out of this hive. So when I put this hive in, it had three carpets of brood on three of the five frames, and a frame of food and a frame of honey. All of the carpets of brood had emerged, and there was not a single stitch of... You know, a lot of times when a hive dies and you pull the frame out, you see some speckled brood that didn't emerge and something's wrong with it or whatever. Nothing. All brood had been emerged and the frames looked absolutely perfect like brood frames should, but empty totally. Now, here's the funny thing. No bees. No bees. None. Zero. Not a dead bee on the bottom board. No bees clustered at all between the frames that didn't make it through winter. Nothing. Completely empty. Pollen still there. Honey on the outside, perfectly fine. And above it, no problem. There were five frames of honey and food available for them up top. So what happened to these bees? No clue. I've seen this two or three times in my tenure as a beekeeper, where you open up a hive and it's just empty like they absconded for no reason. So I don't know. So as for the other double deeps, there were three of them to the other side of the four boxes that I started with. The first double deep, It just looks like it had a moderate amount of bees and didn't have enough bees to keep it warm through the winter. Typical pattern where the queen was on the frame, captured in time while surrounded by her faithful court and whatever bees that tried to keep her going. There were some dead bees on the bottom board. When I opened the hive and look at inside the frame to see if there was any impact for varroa and things like that, no indications, no bad brood. It just looks like they didn't have enough bees to stay warm through the winter. It did have resources available to them. Next hive was pretty much the same thing. It's the last hive that even broke my heart more than the other hive that I was talking about. The two on the outsides were the ones I really, really loved. It was a booming nuke going into winter. I would call it moderate to even strong, and something that absolutely should have survived this winter. In late December, mid-January, this hive was flying, and I thought it would survive, and this would be this, the one. I, even as experienced as I am, saw bees going in and out at the beginning of a warm snap and thought the hive was alive on simple inspection, on spending a few minutes looking at this hive just a few weeks ago. But the other day when I looked at it, it was evident that there were no bees going in with pollen, and I knew the hive was a goner. My guess is fate had a little bit to do with it, and it's the cascade that I spoke of. The four nukes died in the middle. The other one next to that died because just didn't have enough heat. And then eventually the next one succumbed, and this booming hive was sitting out on the windward side, even though it was insulated by itself, and it just did not make it through because it was all by itself and it really needed shared heat from the other hives to make it through. So the most major lesson learned here is that even with insulation and stacked next to each other, weak to moderate hives are just not going to magically survive. And it was my first time and I really gave too much credence to the insulation part. Next year I'm going to start my nukes earlier and make sure they are extremely strong before I cluster them together. And I got greedy. I'll admit it, I got greedy. I didn't know any better. I thought when I insulated them, it would make up for moderate hives. What I really should have done is pinched a queen in something and combined the bees. And together, they all might have survived, and I'd have had some nukes survive. Those two double deeps that were moderate should have been combined to one strong. And maybe if they were sitting next to the other strong, they would have made it through. So that's really a summary notion of the lessons I learned, which are many. If you want to see a more detailed account of what I learned, check out a blog post that I wrote about this in more detail. It's at bkcorner.org, and it's titled Trying to See the Bright Side of Hive Loss. I will say the one thing is, I feel really bad. I never want to experience this. There's grief, and you first have to look at yourself. I did not go into winter with the intention of losing all these hives. But now, in looking at it, in retrospect, it's really easy to see that something has to be different next time. And you learn at the price of the bees, and I feel terrible about that. I'll be the first one to admit it. So one of the more important things to do when you have this happen is you have to look at why things didn't make it through and not just repeat this again next year, which some people I know do. So while I feel bad, I know what I learned, and I will not make these mistakes again. So I have one more left. The 8-frame hive. This one I have to tell you, and because I'm running along, I'm just going to be brief about it. It didn't make it, found the queen, everybody was clustered around her. It looked like a typical winter loss. But with little explanation, when I looked in the frames, I did not see, from my recollection, an indication that varroa had anything to do with this hive not making it. It had enough bees. It certainly had enough bees. I mean, I have my notes, I have my videos that I shot, I know what this hive had. But for some reason, the bees looked like they were sick, and I don't know why. So Bob Kloss was with me. He was there to pick up the Northwest nukes, take them back, the boxes. And we went through this hive and we made a very interesting discovery. On the frame right next to the brood, frames was a frame full of pollen, and on both sides the pollen was encapsulated. Not one or two, but multiple cells, dozen plus on either side, if not more on the one side that faced the brood. So I pulled that frame, and I'm going to send some of that out to Tim Schuller and ask if they can look in their lab and find out why the bees were encapsulating the pollen in my hives. So that got me to thinking, what's going on with the nukes? Maybe that has the same thing. On the frame where the bees have absconded, I looked, and I found one or two cells where the pollen was encapsulated. So it makes me wonder, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I'm going to test, but it makes me wonder what was going on with that hive, because I'm telling you, it had plenty of bees, it had plenty of stores, it just looked good. You know, if you looked in the hive, there were frames and frames of brood, there was plenty of pollen for them to eat, there was honey on the outside still in the bottom box, and the top box still weighed 40 to 50 pounds full of honey for them to eat. There's no reason why this hive should have not made it through winter. So I'll be really interested in reaching into Tim and seeing what he has to say. And to that end, I don't know what's going on in my hives, so all of those nuke boxes, I sealed them all off. And I'll get these things figured out and see if there's something to be concerned about. But how about that for a finding? That's interesting. Makes me wonder. And again, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not going to run around and say there's something going on. But that one, you know, somewhere along the line, I remember Tim Schuller, who's the state apiarist, for people who don't know who Tim is, asked if I had ever seen encapsulated pollen. Well, this is the first time, except for an occasional here or there, I've seen it. When you look in, you'll see cells of pollen. You know what it is. It's orangey, yellowy, or whatever. And then you'll see something where it's capped off with wax. And it's dark and it's a different color, but it's clear that it's pollen that's encapsulated. So that's what I found in that hive. And I'm curious as to whether I go through my other hive or other hives, whether I'll see that anywhere. So I'm going to keep an eye out for that now that I've found it in my apiary. So on the days that the bees were flying, I went and looked at the three deep, and I see pollen going in. I saw what appeared to be robbing, so I closed the hive down quite a bit. I went over to the farm and checked those, and I literally sat and watched the entrances to see if they were bringing pollen in, and they were. Every single hive. So why do I keep saying that? Well, at this time of year, if the bees are bringing in fresh pollen, it's for a purpose. They're feeding brood. If they're just coming and going, it could be they're robbing the hive, but when you see pollen going in. So you want to know if your hives are alive or whether they're being robbed out by opportunistic bees, just watch the entrance. If you see pollen going in, they're feeding something. So local hive report. Man, what a mixed bag. Check. I'll lick my wounds, and I'm going to try and decide whether or not. I'm going to split that 3D hive, the big one that I have. The genetics have lasted a couple years. It's not a huge honey producer for me, and that's not my concern. I want to get some strong nukes going early in the season, so that's my quote-unquote survivor hive. I almost hate that term anymore. But the hive did survive, so Bob Kloss and I were talking about the pattern of take the queen, take some frames, put it in a nuke, and then start to breed from that and let them rebuild the queen in there. And then just use that nuke to build a couple nukes through the season, supplement whatever I have going on. So that's an interesting notion to me. All right, that's the local hive report. Check out that blog post if you wanted to see more lessons learned. For segment number one, this is a bit of an editorial. It's called Show Me the Way, and it's about my direction in 2017. Funny thing is, it's going to sound somewhat similar to 2016 with a couple twists. If you show me a beekeeping video that has theme music with birds playing and some dramatic piano tone, then you'll see me tune absolutely out. I simply deplore dramatizing the plight of the honeybee in that way, or perhaps it's the way that makes you think hippie or tree hugger, and I don't particularly like the way we present our bees in so much trouble that way. Bees need no dramatic piano music and shots of pollinators in, on plants in slow motion anymore. They need real solutions. Don't get me wrong, I feel for the plight of the honeybee and other pollinators. Let's not forget them. And I find myself hypocritical sometimes in that I keep bees in a manner that was created by industry, for industry, and in many respects has industrialized beekeeping, and I'm part of the problem. In industrialization, I'm talking primarily about the shortcomings of our Langstroth design, as I see it, or perhaps my personal opinion that it could be better for the hobbyist if we switched to something else. It might be my underlying reason why deep down I have an innate interest in differing hive form factors for hive management and would love nothing other than design a hive that strikes the balance for the hobbyist first, but it might also lend itself to improving the commercial industry, but not my first concern. I want you to consider this notion. Hobbyists are everywhere in the United States and abroad. Larger commercial beekeepers, by the nature of their business, move bees from hubs that sustain the industry practice in a year-round mode, meaning they're in warmer areas. To be clear, both the hobbyist and the commercial beekeeper have opportunity to affect the population of the bees at large. However, in aggregate, each individual hobbyist, I think, is a formidable force, and I feel collectively we can make a really big difference on the greater ecosystem around the world by our practices. I find myself, the farther I get into my years of beekeeping, looking toward a more natural approach, but still trying to learn beekeeping in a way that will be sustainable for me in my place, in my time. Bob Kloss and I were just talking about, it seems to get harder every year. It seems to be harder. I'm not sure if the bees, the diseases are more virulent or what, who knows. But I would love nothing more than to quit my job and become a full-time beekeeper, but not commercial. I mean a guy out in the world tinkering with bees somewhere in a peaceful mountain valley, designing a hive that could be given back to mankind. It's with that notion that I gravitate toward the treatment-free, or better said, natural approaches and simpler times. My question with modern beekeeping practices, or could we provide a better way, and is the Langstroth hive design holding us back? I see the benefits of my polystyrene hive that I've deployed. I want to learn the ways of my Waray this year, which I didn't have success with last year. And I'm really interested in going into the second year with my top bar. And of course, I have my differing Langstroth hives to consider and learn from, so I'm not getting rid of them. One aspect of this, though, that has emerged is the size of the cavity and insulation properties of the container. I think it's important to consider those things for proper hive design, but I'm going to put a pin in that. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. As important as a hive box is, it's not just about the box. I think when taken in aggregate, the physical ecosystem of the hive is more important when considering the practice of keeping bees. The type of bees, management practices, and in short, again, the ecosystem of the hive and its surroundings. I'll pick one aspect of modern beekeeping and say, why? Why? Why do we use foundation the way that we do? Why? Why? We use it because that's how it's done. It's one of the notions of industrialization that I mentioned a moment ago. Convenience, ready-made, conventional. We can extract from it because the foundation has wires running through it. And who has time to wire frames? That I agree with, by the way. But at what cost? What cost have we traded ourselves to? Wax is the lifeblood of the hive. It's where life begins for a bee. In our world, it could be the equivalent to the womb, but once a bee emerges, it's the home. It's the floor they walk on. It's the walls of their domicile. It's the bed they sleep in. We are told over and over again that wax sucks up anything and everything that we detest. Pesticides, insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, methyl ethyl dithane, holds on to it. We melt that wax down and keep making the foundation of the home for the bees because of the reasons I stated earlier. Why?
Why have we accepted this as an industrialized notion? In the past, I used to be like, perhaps you'll tell me it's minuscule not to worry about it. I said earlier that I'm getting farther along in my beekeeping understanding, and I'm always informing impressions about the practice, and I'm willing to change. Would one ignore radon in their home? You know, you don't spend too much time in your basement, so don't be too concerned about that. It's really unlikely that you'll get ill. How much time could you spend in your basement anyway? Don't worry about the respiratory ailments, that persistent cough, hoarseness, breathing difficulties. Yeah, I know it's the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States, but you know, it's not that strong in your home. Keep a window open when you're testing if you want to get around that failed inspection. By the way, somebody at work recently told me that an inspector told them that when their house failed for radon testing. I've been thinking about 2017 and where I'm going this year. I say this year, but I've been heading in this direction for a few years. I'm not as far as I want to be this year, like previous years, but I'm looking to find ways to get there in bigger bounds. The wax situation is one of my first corrections, foundationless. Foundation only is a matter of a guide to prevent wonky comb, but eventually foundationless. Kelly F. frames are my answer, and eventually I want to swap out all of my frames. As you heard, my nukes did not make it, so I have a setback. I've heard over and again that nukes are the way to go to build comb. My hope, want, desire was to have nukes to build foundationless for swap out. I have to go another route, but given I have multiple colonies to work with this year, I think this year is the year that I could still get some nukes going early and build out comb during the flow. Kevin moment. I have this notion about natural comb. I want to start my hives over and let the bees build the comb the way the colony wants it. Drones go where they want it. Brood goes where they want it. It's a notion that I'm pondering a path to. I'm thinking foundation and some beekeeping practices interfere with how bees design the wax setup in a hive interior, and I'm keen to learn if the bees could do it without foundation, how much differently they would do it from the hive that was built with foundation provided all the way throughout. How much does the foundation influence where they put things, and is it more healthy? Key point, more healthy to let them do it themselves. It's an interesting notion, perhaps, and I think we're going to have to figure out how to get them to build foundationless frames and then start a hive with that idea. End of Kevin moment. So now I want to talk about a more sustainable approach. It's not full-on treatment-free. It's not full-on natural beekeeping, but it's a step in that direction. A few weeks back, I listened to Megan Milbraith give the talk entitled Toward Treatment-Free. I have to wonder in my locale if I can ever go treatment-free. I feel somewhat vindicated recently as a number of differing opinions have surfaced that have backed up my assertion that my problems are my neighbor's problems and vice versa. Research is starting to reveal that varroa mites have demonstrated a behavior in which they can sense a hive is collapsing and take refuge by hopping on the next bee out and making an escape to another colony to prolong their longevity. I know I have beekeepers in my vicinity who have admitted to not treating because they were convinced that treating was not the way to go, and lo and behold, they lost their bees, and yeah, so did I. By the way, I'm not talking of my neighbors Jim and Ida down the street, the one from our association. I know they monitor and treat, so go figure. Other apiaries impact yours if you're within flying distance. The assertion is that any apiary that is in flying distance of another can be linked to that apiary, and any other apiary that is in flying distance of those apiaries can be linked. To illustrate this, one of the recent talks, Dr. Rebecca Masterman from Minnesota showed a map of a city and pointed out that since every hive in the city was in flying distance in one way or another to every other hive, you could consider it one big apiary with perks, benefits, and shared problems. My conjecture here is that the bees are failing for a number of reasons: nutrition, varroa, environmental impacts. And in order to solve the problem, you have to take each one of these things on for their own merit and do something about it. This particular decision about going foundationless is recognizing that one of the pressures could be what is in the wax in my area and eliminating it. Now, let me be clear. Bees build scent and different aspects into the wax, and purging all your wax is not a good idea. You want to maintain something. So as you rotate out, you should rotate out periodically, not big bang, in case anybody is thinking that down the road. So another angle could be the quality of the queen, hygienics, localization, breed, and that too will come in the program. I'm not convinced on the queen front that we have much to say in that. I do think that it is like the Russian roulette. Get a queen in this area from whatever origin and see if it's productive. If it is, try to nurture that stock. What makes a queen so special? Breeding, race, beekeeping, husbandry? No. No. It's nature, folks. Plain and simple, nature. A queen either has what it takes or does not. That's my personal opinion. If either it is productive in your environment or not is dependent upon nature. I believe in understanding genetics, but I don't know that we think we can do all this stuff to influence genetics to the positive, because within a few genetics rotations, a few generations, I should say, genetic choices is diversified in the gene pool, which actually is good for nature, right? My thought process here is we could bring in the most stellar, amazing queen, and within a few generations, it's been diluted. Now, the good news is if you can get that stock that really did make a difference out into the gene pool, then everybody's better for it. But I don't know, folks. I am losing my tolerance for the magic queen quotient of the world. You know, when it comes to queens, we beekeepers talk of them like prized possessions. I think we tend to inflict magical qualities on a queen that's from a productive colony. But like anything else, so many factors influence the success and set the stage for a productive outcome. And conjecture that the queen is at the center of this is sometimes, I think, a fool's errand that we wrap ourselves around the axle with. Now, I'm not saying to covet queens from colonies that are productive, but let's not exalt how amazing a queen is like we do with a quarterback on the Patriots that just won the Super Bowl. Now, maybe that's a bad example because Brady is the best of all time, so they say. But as a general rule, quarterbacks succeed in football because they have a good team surrounding them and they're talented. In short, Varroa-sensitive hygiene queens or a Purdue ankle biter will not solve any of your problems. If the rest of the colony is not of good genetics, it might not hurt, but it's certainly not going to be that magic bullet, I think. It has to be about nutrition, about environment, about all of those things in order for a good queen to be able to do its thing. That's what I think I'm trying to get to. I could systematically go through more components of the ecosystem, but we only have an hour. This is good enough to serve a state of where my head is at. In short, what I'm trying to say is I'm evaluating each component of what I have going on and continuing to look at improving the overall ecosystem where and how I keep bees. I don't know that the insecticide problem or chemicals in hives are as detrimental, but when I bring that problem in, it seems like an easy fix. So first stop is swapping out this comb. Why? I'm not going to use it anymore. So I put a pin in hive design. Let me come back to that. I'm seeing success with beekeepers who have been insulating their hives. It's an observation over the last couple of years. The Langstroth hive design is built for utility and it's a wondrous system. It's convenient, readily available, and very suitable for industry and hobbyists, but perhaps it's too over-engineered. I'm not moving hives. I fully intend to keep them in the yard, and I'm not intending to put them on a pallet and take them to almonds. For the most part, I want to set up a hive on a pad, put bees in it, and keep them for as long as the colony survives. I need the flexibility to grow the brood chamber and accommodate excess stores, and the opposite of that, which is to compress the hives when things slow down in summer dearth. But it's not my first imperative to make it overly mobile. I want to consider weight so I don't develop a bad back. And I want to be legal by having movable comb for inspection. But still, something seems like it can be improved upon. For one, thickness of the hive substrate seems like a place for exploration. I've also felt that hive design should let you manipulate comb without having to pull boxes apart and break seals. Joshua Mark Mastin recently sent me a link on the Slovenian beehive design. As a listener, he thought I would be interested in these, and I saw these in a bee video once, More Than Honey, and they work on a similar principle of the cartridge hive design that I've been mulling over for years. They have something akin to a kitchen cabinet door that you open. You open it, you reach in, and you slide the frame out towards you. Weight, meaning heavy weight, is a hobbyist factor. I don't need a bad back. These require no lifting. In photos, they look similar to the new condo design, which I was just talking about a while ago, which is interesting in its own right. The thought is something that will evolve over time, and I'm still tinkering with it, so I'll stay with the Langstroth for now, but what about these hives stacked next to each other in a new condo thing? That creates its own problems with drifting and other things, which I don't really understand how they do for Slovenian, but yet, very interesting idea. No lifting, open the door, slide the frame out, look at the bees, not a lot of craziness going on. Interesting. So I think I've gone on long enough. I'm looking forward to 2017. I really wish I had the nukes to work with. It seems so counterproductive to split colonies to make nukes during the flow, but I suppose that's better than bees and trees. And hopefully my hives are strong enough to be abundant for the early splits. Time will tell. I'd also like to make some honey this year, but I have still honey left over from last year, so I'm not in dire straits. I have mixed reservations about sharing thoughts like this in detail, and sometimes people go off the reservation on my notions. In some ways, this tells you what motivates me and the state of mind I'm in, and some people don't like that, but at least you have visibility into some of my philosophical bent, and I think it's important for a regular listener to know so they could take what I say with some perspective of how they see the world. So I'll put it out there for you. I suspect that I'm not overly radical in the grand scheme of things, and perhaps it shows that I'm like everyone else in my quest to find out what works to keep bees alive and keep this, more importantly, as an enjoyable and fruitful undertaking. So that's it. If you have any comments, please feel free to share your ideas and notions. I'd be interested in hearing them. Kevin@bkcorner.org is my email address. Let me know where you're writing from and how to say your name. Thanks for listening. For segment number two, I want to talk about sustainable beekeeping biodynamic methods. Might be ironic that in this episode has another feature on the more natural ways of keeping bees, but it's by happenstance that I happen to have this topic prepped at this time. At a recent meeting, a fellow local beekeeper and I got to talking about keeping bees, and I was aware that she studied with Gunther Hawk, a noted biodynamic beekeeper, and she considered his practice of keeping bees for her colonies and the farm that she operates. It just so happens that I had a source in the queue to talk about the biodynamic approach to keeping bees from a biodynamic website that I had bookmarked long ago. Specifically, I had keyed in on a document by someone named Michael Weiler about the practices and the notion that this type of beekeeping aims to address the unity of the colony and it's not about the individual parts. She provided me with some background resources to review, and I spent a little time looking through the books she had on the topic and a DVD from Gunther himself to get a sense of what the biodynamic approach is all about. In addition to what she shared, I spent some time looking at various resources on the web for how the approach is managed. What I learned, and I am being very summary here, is that there are certain tenets to keeping bees this way, and you either follow them and are biodynamic, or you don't, and therefore can't consider yourself in the method. It's akin to veganism as an example. There are rules about what you can or cannot eat and how you make your choices. Veganism. Is that the right word? Anyway, my guess is most are not familiar with this approach, and my intention here is to introduce the topic and provide a springboard so you can learn more if this tickles your fancy. What I'll go through is a smattering of points in no particular order, but when I'm done, I think you'll have a sense of what it is and some of the foundational principles. To get started, we'll recount a summary as posted on one of the biodynamic websites I've found about what it is. The website says, the biodynamic approach to keeping bee colonies is based on respecting their natural lifestyles and the integrity of the colony. Its aim is to promote the health of bees by minimizing stress factors and to let them develop in accordance with their true nature. Bees are allowed to build natural comb, and swarming is acknowledged as the only way to rejuvenate and reproduce the colony. The queen is allowed to move freely throughout the hive, and sufficient honey is retained in the hive to provide for the winter. To expand this concept in more detail, I'll start with one other notion from that description I gave you. My words, not theirs. It seems that all things are connected. Not a new concept, but perceived undertone from me about this style of beekeeping that I keep getting. The circle of life, as we learned from the movie, it's all connected. Kevin moment. You know, you have to hand it to Disney. The concept of the circle of life from The Lion King is an impression left upon millions. Like Bugs Bunny cartoons with certain messaging inside the cartoon and other forms of entertainment like The Simpsons or Wonder Years or other shows, there's a lot to learn from creative minds. Pro and con, I guess, but one can't help but thinking of The Lion King, or at least in my feeble little mind, it conjures up the image when talking about the connectedness of the world and the circle of life. Sing the song. End of Kevin moment. So in order for bees to be healthy, plants need to be healthy. In order for plants to be healthy, soil must be healthy. In order for the soil to be healthy, the water needs to be pure. In order for the water to be pure, ... You get it, right? The implication of these things and the interconnectedness for beekeeping implies that the bees, and perhaps the queens, are not all they can be these days because the balance is off, and that impacts the nutrition that makes up the actual bee and its body. And it could be at the core of our problems for our colonies. And therefore, if you embrace the whole biodynamic approach, your bees will be better off. This same notion sounds familiar to me from a book that I read called The Dorito Effect, where they talk about the quality of chicken as one aspect in our food industry. The lack of flavor in our foods requires us to eat more to be satiated. In the chicken, they bred a different type of chicken to look good, so it looked great in the store. But when you ate it, it didn't taste as good, and therefore you ate more of it to be satiated because it wasn't nutritionally as found, because part of the way to get the chicken to look good was to feed it something that wasn't natural. Now, if you take a regular chicken and put it out and let it meander around the grass and eat bugs and things like that, it has better omega-3s and things. And nutritionally, it's better than the ones they're feeding corn and things that are not normal. In a parallel effect, I saw a documentary on Netflix about Chef's Table, where they were saying that the food in a restaurant that a family had for generations didn't taste as good, and they traced it back to the fact that the farm that they used simplified and went to single products for vegetables, But the thing they were missing is they used to keep chickens in the yard, and the waste from the chicken changed the soil, which made the food taste better. Therefore, the food they were serving didn't taste as well and wasn't as good nutritionally. If you parallel that to the bees, the ecosystem that we've been changing in farming industry is creating something that makes a less healthier queen. And we as humans are being impacted by that because our chicken stinks. It's not as good nutritionally for us. Now, this whole thing isn't about nutrition and whatever. Biodynamics has quite a few aspects to it, but just pointing out a couple things along this line. But there is something to be said about the fact that maybe the queens are not lasting as long because the nutrition that they're getting, which they can't impact, that's being brought to them, is just not as good. Maybe that has to do with it. So when it comes to the biodynamic approach, I'm less than a novice or a rookie. I've really read a couple things on it. Now I'm trying to tell you I know what it is. I'm an outright Luddite, so I ask you to keep that in mind as I recount what I've learned. But one of the things I had as a natural curiosity is, what's the difference between biodynamic versus organic? Is it the same? Is it different? The answer is it's different. I'll sum it up, but fundamentally things are viewed differently. The biodynamic farm, for example, is considered a thing. The farm. It's a self-sustaining organism. Organic practices are simpatico in many ways with the biodynamic approach, but biodynamic farming, beekeeping, and other practices have a more comprehensive governance to consider. And in the big picture, there are metaphysical and spiritual underpinnings in the practice. So these practices tie back to a person named Rudolf Steiner. Rudolf Steiner gave these tenets, and from that, this was born. So Rudolf Steiner, who is he? Rudolf Steiner was born in the 1860s and was seeking a synthesis between science and spirituality, something he termed spiritual science. An Austrian philosopher, social reformer, and architect, he seems to be the person that was at the father of this movement. So I said there were spiritual underpinnings in the practices. There was a document online that had a presentation by Rudolf that talked about his notion of the bees as one point, and I'll give you a taste of what you might learn about the social underpinnings. I said social, spiritual underpinnings. This was a documented lecture on the topic of bees. It was found in Lecture 2 of 9, and it was given November 26, 1923. These 9 lectures appear to be the fundamental tenet to this biodynamic approach, based on what I could see. But it draws a connection with the incubation period of a worker and the sun. Here's a snippet from one of the paragraphs. The sun revolves around its own axis once in 21 days. Then it returns again, and the first point is again here. If this were to continue, only such sun workings would be there as had once been there already. So the worker bee, by the time it is fully developed, has experienced all that the sun can give. Should the worker bee continue to develop, it must leave the sun and enter the earth development. It will then no longer be having a sun influence in its development because it already has had this and has tasted it to the full. Now it passes into the earth development, but only as a perfect insect, as a matured creature. I might say, the worker bee occupies herself only momentarily with this earth development and has then finished with her sun development, is entirely a creature of the sun. Isn't that an interesting notion? I never would have ever thought it that way. Nor do I want to assert whether this 21-day cycle has any merit with the vitality of the colony. I'm simply sharing this to illustrate some of the foundations of this ideology. I shared this in hopes to make the connection that it goes beyond my simple circle of life analogy, and it connects the spiritual with the metaphysical aspects that seem to underpin this approach to beekeeping. The bee is all that it can be because it took 21 days while the sun was on a full rotation. So the biodynamic approach looks at the colony as a superorganism, which are my words, but I think that's right. I'm going to go down a level in the ecosystem and stay within the system and practices of keeping bees. The importance of the bees, the workers, the drones, and of course the queen are fundamental. Actually, as I just expressed in my early segment, one cannot leave out the wax and substrates that make up the hive. And that goes for other aspects of beekeeping, too. For example, nest size and shape are tenets of keeping bees in the biodynamic way. The expression of natural comb building and the rounded shapes of natural comb follow something akin to the catenary curve principle or golden ratio of cavity shapes and are required by the process. Catenary curve, golden ratio, huh? If I lost you, let me explain. If you looked at how bees build comb in nature, the shape of the overall comb is not rectangular nor frame-shaped like a Langstroth box. They are wide at the top and have a rounded bottom that's akin to the shape of a rope left to hang free while holding it at two ends. The curve that naturally occurs for the rope is referred to as a catenary curve and generally follows a certain proportion referred to as the golden ratio. So in short, the curve at the bottom of a natural comb with no guides is as nature intended it. So I said something about size. Hive cavities are another consideration. Typically it's said that a proper hive has a brood diameter of 350 millimeters. I'm citing a volume from an FAQ from Michael Weiler, who has published materials on the biodynamic way. His FAQ indicates that a proper dimension requires different size frames from conventional and a brood area that consists of 10 to 12 frames, 350 millimeters by 350 millimeters, with, of course, an optional 100 millimeters between the brood box and the floor. And combs should be allowed to be built by the bees in the way the bees want it. And what I mean is no foundation, and they get to put drones where they want, workers where they want, make queen cells where they want, and so on. No manipulation by the beekeeper. It appears to me that there are rules and there are guidelines that one should follow to consider one a biodynamic beekeeper. And I'll spend a few seconds here with a short list in no particular order. This is kind of like if you're a normal beekeeper, you can ask questions like differing hive form factors, are they okay or not? So, yeah, they talk about skeps, sun hives, top bars, warre, Langstroth hives. They're all okay. But they must accommodate the brood size chamber that falls within the guidelines that I was just talking about to be correct. Well, wiring frames, is that okay? Yeah. But it should be stainless steel if you're going to use them. And if you don't have metal, that's all the better, because metal is not a thing you'll find in nature. Foundation is not used. But starter strips are acceptable, but it has to use clean wax and never commercial wax that is unpure. To be clear, I'm sure that plastic of any kind is just flat out not going to be an option. So the same goes for hive substrates. Only natural materials, straw, wood, clay, dung. It's not a joke, by the way. But certainly not plastics or polystyrene. By the way, dung, cow dung in particular, from what I know, was something that was used quite a bit to close the gaps and skeps and things like that. It has certain insulation and properties that make a good beehive. The exterior should be treated only with ecologically safe treatments, meaning no paint from the hardware store. Queens, as a rule, are not replaced by beekeepers. You had a bad queen, nature will take care of it. And there's no use of artificial insemination. or certain queen production techniques like grafting. It's just not allowed. I don't know that doing the practice of clipping a queen's wings as a form of swarm prevention is practiced that much anymore, but of course it would not be permitted for you to do that in this method. So speaking of swarming, I think I'm going to cover a few management techniques, do's and don'ts, as part of the biodynamic way. And of course, it says beekeeping practices should be close to natural as possible, but from what I could see, there appears to be some leeway on a few things. Bees should be allowed to swarm if that's their intention, and one resource I read seems to indicate that 30% of the hive swarming should be expected. So let me talk a minute about swarming in the biodynamic approach from what I gathered, because it's a big topic. On swarm control, it seems that swarms are okay, meaning let the swarm go, it's natural. However, we as beekeepers and even biodynamic beekeepers do not want to see our bounty fly away. So even the biodynamic approach, there are measures to manage swarming. And I would venture that, you know, if you're in a city, you don't want your hive swarming to your neighbors and things, so they have to provide something. So for swarm control, beekeepers are instructed on how to know the identify of a buildup for swarming and add size to the hive to provide more space and thwart it. As a fundamental tenet, swarming is recognized as a natural form of reproduction. And if adding space works to thwart the swarm, then good. Let the colony grow, and when the season comes to a close and it starts to contract, scale it back. If someone wishes to go an alternate path, it's permitted to pull the queen out with some bees and house them in a box away from the colony for a few days, and then you add them to a new hive with empty frames. In essence, it would be like the hive left and was hanging in a tree. And in this case, you've nurtured them by maintaining them in a safe place in a box or a package, and then you install them in a hive just as if you'd capture a swarm. Moving away from swarming, feeding bees, pollen substitutes are not permitted. Feeding in general seems to be not practiced, but if you're going to do it, honey and natural pollen are the foods of the bees. In an emergency situation, I guess you could feed a colony to keep it from dying. If you find yourself in a situation where you need to feed bees for survival circumstances, you can feed them, but it has to be at least 10% honey. And biodynamic practices also stipulate the addition of chamomile tea and salt. You cannot, however, do stimulative feeding, just not permitted in the practice. So, of course, with all these management practices, the million-dollar question, what about varroa? The first answer is the vitality of the bees kept in this manner will enable them to handle disease and pests. After a time, bees managed in the biodynamic way will be able to cope far better with things that come their way. If varroa infestation is a problem, there are some options. The use of organic acids is permitted, like formic and oxalic. There are also other approaches cited, including herbal teas, sodium carbonate for disinfecting of AFB, and the use of heat. While thymol is a natural product, it's not permitted for use due to the residue it leaves in wax. It should be apparent that, as part of an integrated pest management system, drones are cherished as much as the queen and workers, so culling them as a means of getting rid of varroa mites is not an acceptable practice. As a practice, there's other notions, but I feel like I'm going a little bit too long. I think probably I've only tipped the iceberg on the topic, and what I provided, it was more of a laundry list of do's and don'ts. And I don't want to discredit what's at the heart of the theory, which is the big picture notion of the earth, the land, the plants, the bees, the planets, and such. It's all one big ecosystem, and if we as humans were not here now, how would the bees do it? But since we are here now, and since we desire to keep bees, how can we do it in a way that's close to what nature intends? I have seen videos and heard talks of people who follow some of these practices, and for the most part, I sense a zen with the bees that I have come to appreciate. I feel as if it's a quaint notion, and I have my reservations of how it would work in full practice in this region of the United States. But then again, if we all followed these ideals, what would the state of beekeeping be in? That's an interesting question. I do watch people who keep bees in a very calm manner, that make sure they don't kill a single bee, all that, and I do think there's some sort of harmony there that some of us miss out on. So there appears to be information out there on the internet, and certainly books and DVDs that do more justice than I have in how this really works. If you search on the term biodynamics, you'll find a whole bunch of websites on the topic. But I must say, personally, I didn't like what I found. It seems that some folks in this world have found a way to commercialize this feel-good notion, and if you subscribe to them, they'll show you the way. They seemed way too focused on selling packages describing how this is to me. If they really wanted to do this, they would explain in detail what it is and embrace people accepting the notion and not have some sort of paywall. Okay, I'm not going to trivialize what it takes to take on stewardship of people who want to know this method, and maybe I'm being a little too harsh. Anyway, I'd be remiss to mention one other slant to the biodynamic way. There's a standard, or it might even be correctly referred to as a brand, that ensures a certain biodynamic approach is being adhered to. The International Demeter Association, called ironically Demeter International, was founded in 1997 and ensures that only strict controlled and contractually bound partners are permitted to use the Demeter brand. Its history is founded on the 8 lectures of Rudolf Steiner that I quoted from a few moments ago. It has the standards to which I have to be met, and of course the entire program for certification of the biodynamic approach that you can follow. I would suppose that if you intended to learn and follow the biodynamic approach, that the Demeter standards would be the gold standard, but again, I'm a novice and I'm only speculating based on what I saw. I think it probably has the most organized explanation of the biodynamic approach and how to apply the principles for production, processing, labeling, and of course, the beekeeping do's and don'ts are on their website. So going through this took a long time, but I knew it would going in. It's an interesting approach, and if you're a foodie, it's probably the closest thing to the terroir notion of the food you eat is a byproduct of the environment it's grown in, and some of these food-to-table moments that are ascending in popularity these days. There's a strong underpinning in our country that we have to amend our ways, lest doom and pestilence come to all of us. And I feel as if the millennial generation wants to change things and move to a more wholesome and connected with late nature lifestyle. And this is something, the biodynamic way, that offers options. So that alone made me want to dig in and learn more about it, and I hope you enjoyed the slight journey with me here. I'll have a number of links on the show notes for things that I referenced and or referred to in putting this together. So take a look at bkcorner.org.
And take a look at the show notes for show 105. So time to wrap things up. You know, I wanted to record that for quite a while. I've had that on the pile and kept pushing it down because I couldn't quite figure out how to cover it. And a recent encounter with a biodynamic beekeeper brought it back to the forefront. And she lent me some materials to read. And I remember, I don't know which episode it was. You can go back to Ley Lines, a topic I covered. It came from her, and it's funny, I've known her for a number of years and have seen her on and off, but never really understood the way she kept bees. And recently, when I dropped the materials off with her, she took me out back and showed me her hives, and she's been doing it for 5 years, has never lost a hive,
And I saw a lot of neat novel approaches. She showed me an interesting Gunther Hawk hive entrance device that you set down, and it has a slider that lets you adjust the size. Very well engineered. She had these clear plastic sheets that were leaning against the front of her hive. They were the corrugated clear material that you might put on a roof. And she uses them, and I could just look at them and say, they're very fascinating to me because they'll radiate heat, they'll protect from wind, and they create a natural barrier. Just a couple little things that she had done. She was using double bottom boards, a solid underneath and screen underneath the hive, and using white cafeteria trays to slide underneath to check the mites. It's a bunch of little things that she was doing that I think adds up to her success. And at some point, I'm hoping to take a video camera over and do a little coverage and just talk about different things she has going on. The other neat thing was she had different form factors, top bars and garden hives and things like that, which I thought were really, really cool. So kudos to her. She's doing a great job keeping her bees alive. She has an incredible location. Seems isolated. Lots of forage around her. Very envious about her location and its capabilities there. So maybe somewhere down the road I'll have a follow-up to this. I wanted to mention I've been working over the weekend on something for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association. Adding a new section to their website for the upcoming public season. You know, there's times when we do public outreach and we get so many questions at times over certain things. And I thought I would finally address when we do fairs and things like that, people come and they want to locate honey. And a lot of times when people come to a fair, they're from some other place and not local to us, meaning Hunterdon and Warren County. So we built a honey locator resource on our website to tell you where to go. You can go to honey.com and pick your state and find the honey providers. Hive placement requests, another thing that we get, people who have properties but don't want bees, but they would like to have bees on their property. What to do with swarm captures and bee removals. Bee identification is something really important. A lot of people call, they see a swarm, they're not sure what it is. I built a page to explain to them what a bee looks like versus all the other different critters that you'll find. And the other thing I thought that was interesting is we get so much interest from the public about what is a beehive, what goes on, how do bees overwinter. And I thought it would be interesting just to provide a simple resource that explains the basics of a beehive for somebody who came along. And we get a lot of teachers and educators and new beekeepers who would love to have a resource like that. So figured we'd build some of these for our website. So this week, Friday or Saturday, I'm going to Westchester University for a talk. I'm a bit bummed out because the Northwest branch is also having a meeting on that Saturday where President Jim McCauley is presenting on iPhone photography and using those add-on lenses for beekeeping. I really wanted to go to that, but unfortunately, I had already committed to go to Westchester. Bob Kloss was going to go with me, but he's going to hang back and help out at the Northwest meeting. So it looks like I'm going on my own, but I'm committed and want to go, and I should be committed. And I'm looking forward to that meeting. Got a lot of things to do around the house, but had this one penciled in, and I'm just going to commit to it and go. Now, Dewey Caron is one of the speakers there. He's coming back to our area near Trenton to speak on Sunday. Last year he did that. I was unavailable, and a lot of people said it was just amazing. So, I'm going to talk to Sharon and see if she's going to let me make it a two-day weekend. That's really pushing it. Okay, time to tie things up. Visit our website, bkcorner.org. Write in to me, kevin@bkcorner.org, if you have any thoughts or just want to say hello. Make sure you tell me how to say your name and where you're from. And I'll leave you like I always do, like our beloved bees. When beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody, and be well.